is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. We're doing this for IEEE Security and Privacy magazine, where portions of this interview will appear in print in the May-June issue. You can find out more about IEEE Security and Privacy magazine at www.computer.org/security. This is the first in a series of interviews with various security gurus, and I'm happy to have with me today Professor Avi Rubin. Hi, Avi.
Hi, how you doing, Gary?
Avi is a professor at Johns Hopkins University and director of the Information Security Institute there. He's also the director of a National Science Foundation Accurate Center, which is focused on electronic voting. Avi is the author of 5 very popular security books, the latest being Brave New Ballot, which is aimed at a much wider audience this time and will be published by Random House. I'm sure that's pretty exciting. Avi was born in Kansas and grew up in Tennessee. He was educated in Michigan, where he got his PhD in 94 at the University of. And he's part of a generation of security researchers who really have completely shaken up the field since the mid-90s. We're very pleased to have you join us, Avi.
It's great to be here.
So you've done some outstanding work on security and privacy throughout the years, from crowds to the RFID hack, which got lots of press, to critical work in electronic voting, which continues to get lots of press. What was the most fun?
I'd say that the RFID project was the most fun at the time that we did it, because we were able to actually go to gas stations and buy gas without speed passes and start cars. I mean, it made a tremendous demo.
What gave you the idea to work on that project?
Well, we were sitting around in our lab, and I think it was Kevin Fu. Kevin was a graduate student at MIT who came to spend his last couple of years of his PhD in my lab here at Johns Hopkins. And I think it was Kevin who held up a speed pass in his hand because he had just gotten it and said, "I wonder how secure this thing is."
Oh, that's great.
That's all it took for my guys.
And so then they started working on, how long did it take to break it once they sort of decided over beers to do it?
It took 3 months, but not a normal 3 months, because once the guys got into it, they started working around the clock on it, and they weren't getting much sleep, and they were pretty much obsessed with it. And the hardest part was figuring out what the cryptographic algorithm was that was on the SpeedPass, because it was a proprietary algorithm that Texas Instruments had designed.
So you had to reverse that algorithm out and then, I guess, fabricate some hardware to...
Right, well, we had pretty much only black box access to them. So what we did is we got a kit from Texas Instruments. They sold evaluation kits, and we were able to send challenges to the thing and get back responses. And we were also able to program in a key. And so what we got a lucky break when one of the guys was at the library and found a high-level diagram of what the algorithm might be like from a Texas Instruments conference presentation. And it turned out that the diagram was pretty wrong, but it was close enough that once we were able to feed in some test keys and run some experiments, we're slowly able to reverse engineer the entire algorithm.
I think there's an important lesson there, you know, because attackers actually use their resources more than some people let on. You know, they have, a lot of people talk about hackers being these guys who do random fuzzing or just arbitrarily send input to your web application. But it turns out that attackers use libraries and go look stuff up and understand algorithms better than a lot of us think.
That's right. I think when people make assumptions about attackers, like one that of my favorites is, well, no one will try that. That's where you run into trouble when you decide how secure something is. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the attacker might just be a disgruntled former employee, and I've seen that happen before. And so you can't make any assumptions about what the attackers know or don't know or have or don't have.
I really like that point. In fact, Dan Geer has an excellent little story that I stole and put in my latest book, which describes that as the ultimate scenario to think about when you're thinking about your own system security. That is, you fire your best engineer after really insulting them, and you throw them out on the street. What can they do to break your system?
And for most people, the answer is everything.
Yeah, that's a problematic answer, I guess.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting about you is that you look like the boy next door, and yet under that mild-mannered exterior lies the mind of a various, you know, devious attacker. So the real question is, how did you learn to break things?
Well, I think that it started out early in my career. I became a security person because I was working at the University of Michigan, where most of the work is funded by the auto industry, and the only thing about the vehicles research that was going on that I found interesting was looking at the proposed automatic toll collection systems, which now are pretty widespread, but in those days was just kind of a futuristic idea, and coming up with ways that you could steal from it, that you could drive through without paying. And I made a kind of a hobby of looking through the designs that were being proposed and saying, well, here's how people could cheat. And so my advisor didn't know what to do with me because I kept trying to break the rules. And he introduced me to Peter Honeyman, who was doing research in security, among other things. And we spoke about security and breaking systems. And my philosophy is that the best way, and really I think the only way, to learn how to make secure systems and design things so that they can withstand attack is to know how to think like an attacker and to actually be an attacker in the white hat sense, where you're not really stealing from people or breaking systems and maliciously causing them to fail, but you're breaking them for pedagogical reasons.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. But there's one trick, there's sort of a wrinkle there. Isn't it harder to build security into a system than it is to break a system? And, you know, does the, like, let's say you're doing security testing, does the obvious lack of a break during an assessment like that mean that something is secure?
That's a very common misconception. The thing is, the attacker only has to succeed once, right? They can try a whole lot of things, and they're not really time-bounded. You've got a system out there, and the attacker can work at every possible little creative nuance, and they may think of something that the designer didn't think of. What's worse for the designer and the person building a system is they have to commit to what the system is going to be like. They have to, at some point, actually build a system. It's not a hypothetical system. And once they've committed to that in a finite amount of time, then the attacker can apply virtually infinite resources to trying to break it continuously. And so the attacker has the advantage of unpredictability and of being able to try things that perhaps the designer didn't think of.
Mm-hmm. So that's a big problem.
Yeah.
But does that mean we should just throw up our hands and just not even try to build security into systems?
Well, I don't think so. You know, one of the analogies I like to use is if you had, you know, a door with a combination lock, right, and you had to design it. And then there's the question, well, is that door secure? Well, one way to measure that is to go up to it and try to open the combination, and then if you fail, you could say, yes, it's secure, I failed. And then somebody else maybe walks up and tries, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it works, and they get in. And so the question is, you know, was that secure? And the answer is, well, it depends. If you knew that extra bit of information, it wasn't. And anybody in hindsight looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 knows it's not secure, but it may actually deter people and keep a lot of attackers out, and so it's a good idea to put it there.
I see. So it's sort of an exercise in risk management then, and one of the questions you need to consider is what your attacker is likely to do and how much it costs to stop those sorts of attacks.
I think you have to look at it from an economic point of view. What is the cost of the security measure that you're putting in? What is the cost of the asset that you're protecting? And what are the resources that an attacker is likely to apply? And you can actually create formulas for all of those things and determine the level of security that you need to put in.
So does it worry you that in order to do this properly, as you said before, you really do need to think like an attacker, even if you're wearing your white hat? Does it worry you to teach kids in the university setting how to be devious and underhanded like this?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think there are always people that can go wrong, but in the academic setting, the students that I get in my classes, at least, are much more likely to find themselves in a job where they have to defend against attackers than to actually be an attacker. And that doesn't mean that some of them won't, but just like you teach people to use weapons when they're going to a school for law enforcement, and yes, one of them could go use that weapon against someone, but more likely they're going to use that skill and knowledge to protect society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when you're trying to teach people these things, do you talk about ethics in some of your courses explicitly?
Yes, we actually, there's an interesting point that this brings up, which is that we have a certification in the engineering school here for many of the departments called ABET, and the computer science department is getting it. That's the national certification of a curriculum that's out there. And one of the requirements is that there be an ethics component. And my course is actually one of the ones that's being used to show that we do have ethics, because we have a great focus on the ethics of hacking and the ethics of breaking into systems for good, which is something that a lot of people need to be aware of as an important component of a security policy.
Right. So tell me about some of the fun things that you've done with your classes to help get points across about security and privacy. And I know you've done some really fun exercises. What was your favorite?
My favorite was the one that I did about a year ago in my class. I gave the students the assignment of and I like to make the projects sort of adversarial, where the some groups are competing against the other groups. And so I broke them up into groups of four students, and I gave them the assignment of learning from public sources as much as they could about the residents of Baltimore City.
Wow.
And then what they had to do is challenge each other in front of the class. And so they had to build databases that they could access easily.
Are you a resident of Baltimore City?
I am not a resident of Baltimore City. Otherwise, I would have probably not assigned it that way. But it was really unbelievable what they were able to come up with. And, I threw out names of people when they were being tested at the end of the semester, just people that I knew that lived in Baltimore City, and I thought, they could give me their name, their spouse, their income, how much they paid for their house, how many children they had, details about their shopping habits. The groups that did really well all came up with exactly the same number of residents, which was something like 495,000.
Wow.
And so there are databases out there to be mined.
And what do you think the students learned by doing this exercise?
Well, I believe the students learned about the exposure of personal information and how little privacy there actually is, because they were not permitted to spend money to dig into illegal sources, although several of them told me about offers they had from clerks in government offices to sell them lists of Social Security numbers. And they were not allowed to do that. They could only follow legal means and publicly available databases. Now, real attackers in the real world do not restrict themselves that way.
Are you sure?
Well, I don't think so.
So let's switch gears a little bit. A lot of your work has sort of a political, almost libertarian bent to it. I'm thinking of things like crowds, where you're working on peer-to-peer privacy, or your work on electronic voting. Can you work on things like that without being politicized?
You know, it's funny that you mention it, because it did occur to me after a while that that was the case, and I've actually never considered myself a particularly politically active person. The crowds project came up because it was very technically interesting, and I thought it would be good for society. I don't talk as much about an interesting project that I worked on with respect to a gambling system. And that, again, the problems attract me for their technical reasons. And that was true until I got into voting. The issues with electronic voting, voting is by its nature political, is the first time in my life that I got really engaged in a project for public cause, because I noticed that the electronic voting machines that were being used across the country were not only insecure, but they weren't recountable, and they were riggable. That means, and that may be a word that I invented, but they could have been rigged by the people who made them, with no way to discover that, possibly. And so I became very, very concerned as a citizen, and the role that I've been playing in the electronic voting arena has gone from initially being looking at the technical aspects of it to what could be called as activism.
Yeah, well, I know that in order to understand the democratic system better, you actually became an election judge in Timonium, Maryland.
That's right, and fortunately for this coming election in 2006, I've been assigned to my home precinct, so I won't have to get up at 4:45 in the morning. I'll be able to get up at 5.
What was that experience like? Who else was there, and how did that go?
It was tremendous. I was a regular poll worker, what we call election judges in Maryland, and the election in 2004 happened around the time that the work I was doing got a lot of publicity, as did I, And so the president of Diebold Election Systems actually showed up in my precinct with a team from Diebold just to make sure, I guess, that everything went okay. and this was for a primary in which we had 199 voters show up in the course of a 16-hour day.
Uh-huh.
So we had, you know, 9 poll workers, 5 voting machines, 4 or 5 representatives of Diebold, and 199 voters throughout the day, and a bunch of reporters.
Well, it's probably harder to commit fraud in your district then.
Well, yeah, Maryland is not one of the pivotal states in the election.
So do you hold out hope that electronic voting eventually can be as good as whatever we have now or before? Or what's the situation there?
Well, I do think there's a lot of hope for electronic voting, and I by no means believe that we shouldn't use computers in our voting process. But it's important for us to realize what computers are good at and when computers can be dangerous. Computers are very good at providing nice interfaces for people, and computers are very good at performing repeatable tasks that can be difficult for humans. But another thing is that that voting machines and computers consist of a lot of software. And software, as you very well know and as you've pointed out in your books, is something that has definitely guaranteed to have bugs in it. It's going to behave in ways that are unexpected. And if we know that and if we design our systems to tolerate that, then we're going to be okay. But we can't just throw electronic voting machines that are built like .com applications into our voting booths and expect everything to be okay.
Right, right. So some assurance work is necessary, and probably with the right amount of that, we can do electronic voting.
Yeah, I do believe so.
And that's what you're working on at Accurate, I assume.
That's right. We got a grant from the National Science Foundation. There are 10 of us, professors from across the country who have an interest in this issue, to set up a center, and we have a 5-year timeline to study this issue and provide solutions.
Well, I'm sure you're glad you're on the good guys team.
I don't know. If I was on the bad guys team, I might be able to put my favorite person in as president.
So speaking of your favorite person, who has influenced
besides
your...
Gary McGraw?
Who has influenced your career the most?
Well, that's a tough question that I hadn't considered before. I would say that right up there are Steve Belevin and Bill Cheswick, who I had the good fortune of working with Steve while I was at AT&T, and they wrote a seminal book in 1994 about firewalls and internet security, and they approached me about co-authoring the second edition with them, and I thought that would be a tremendous experience. But what I didn't realize, that the real tremendous part of that would be that I got to sit down for a year and a half almost every day with the two of them and brainstorm. And
yeah, that's great.
I just learned so much from those two, and you know, I think Steve's career is a model for the kind of career I want to have.
Have you read any good books lately?
Let's see. I haven't had much time to do any reading. I did enjoy your trilogy of books, and I believe that the exploiting software and building security in are being received by the industry in a way that's different from a lot of the security books that have been popping up left and right, because your books are actually useful.
So I was thinking more of fiction or books outside of work. Do you read
okay? Pretending that I have a life outside of work.
It's okay, Avi.
So I read a book that I really liked recently. It has nothing to do with computers, and it's called Making the Mummies Dance. Have you heard of that?
I haven't.
It's by Thomas Hoving, who was a 30-year director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And in it, he describes, it's kind of a memoir, where he describes his tenure in that position and some of the big acquisitions that the museum had and some of the internal politics with donors and other people in the museum. And it was just a fascinating book. I strongly recommend it.
Great. And then most importantly of all, what's your favorite breakfast cereal?
My favorite breakfast cereal to eat is Fruit Loops. But I almost never eat it because it's full of sugar. So I typically just eat cornflakes.
But of course your kids have to have Fruit Loops in the house because they like it.
My kids do control many aspects of my life.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Avi.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue features articles on the Fourth Amendment and surveillance, combating spam, internet filters, and putting code review tools to work. Subscribe today at URL www.computer.org/security/BSI sub. This is Gary McGraw.